E.J. Dionne is the best-selling author of Why Americans Hate Politics and Our Divided Political Heart, and one of the nation's most influential political journalists. He explains the story behind today's headlines with his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism, From Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. In his narrative, he illuminates the history of Republican politics from the Barry Goldwater era through the Reagan Revolution and up to the present crisis. With his perspective and contemporary reporting, he explains the unrest and discontent on the right and the Republican Party's bitter civil war, while illustrating why a radicalized conservatism has made governing our country so difficult. E.J. Dionne is a best-selling author, Washington Post syndicated columnist, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and professor at Georgetown University. He's also a regular commentator right here on NPR on Fridays, as well as on MSNBC. The name of the book is Why the Right Went Wrong, and it's a pleasure to welcome E.J. Dionne back to the roundtable. E.J., thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Always it's nice great to be with you. Great to be connected to Albany and that area. I'm a New Englander who lived in Albany for 4 years, Albany and the area for 4 years.
Now, you covered state politics for the New York Times. Was that a pleasurable experience, or do you learn a lot in that?
Oh, it was a great experience. I was there when Hugh Carey was governor. I covered the election of Mario Cuomo in 1982. It was sort of the end of the fiscal crisis in New York City, a real kind of crisis of governance where New York, both state and city, got through a very hard time. It didn't have all of the explosions that affected New York politics later on, but I was perfectly content with that. I think there's nothing more educational than covering a state legislature and its interactions with the governor.
Do you get a sense or a false sense of covering the Northeast, covering even New York specifically, when we zoom this out and look at why the right went wrong, of even what the right is when you are mired in New York State?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The book is about the present, but it tries to bring, it's in significant part a historical book that goes all the way back to Goldwater. And so if people want a history of the last 50 years told with a particular optic on the right, but focusing on a lot of other things, that's what I've done here. It's funny because New York State is obviously seen as a liberal bastion, which in many ways it is. But New York was also the scene of an awful lot of the early rumblings of the conservative movement. National Review magazine was based in New York City. William F. Buckley Jr. ran for mayor of New York City in 1965, which was a very important campaign in terms of expanding Buckley's reach and putting conservative ideas on the table. Obviously, a conservative party was formed in New York State to push the Republicans to the right quite successfully on the whole back in the early 60s. And then Jim Buckley, of course, was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1970 on a split of the liberal vote, which I talk about some in the book as well. So New York, while being in the broad sense a liberal state, it did vote for Reagan. And it was a scene of a lot of important bits of conservative, more than bits, important moments of conservative organizing over the years.
You wanted to give us the history, and you look back to 1964 and Barry Goldwater's bid for the presidency, which failed. Talk a little bit about that movement and how it set us up as a baseline to where we have grown to now.
I think a lot of people are trying to answer the question, where did Donald Trump come from? Why have Donald Trump and, at least for now, Ted Cruz emerged as the two leading Republicans? And what I argue is that since the Goldwater campaign, the history of American conservatism has been a story of disappointment and betrayal. Because since Goldwater, the party leaders have made a lot of promises that were rooted in Goldwater's promises. And we, just by the way, we remember the Goldwater who became kind of avuncular and was a critic, for example, of the religious right later in life. But he was a real hardcore ideologue in 1964. And if you go back to his book, The Conscience of a Conservative, it reads like a Tea Party book. I argue that there's been less change on the right than we think. I have a chapter called The New, New, Old right in the book. And so conservatives since Goldwater, in order to win support from an increasingly conservative party, have had to promise a much smaller government than they could ever achieve. They promised to roll back cultural changes that the country on the whole has accepted. And they have of late talked about changing the demographic makeup of the United States, which is impossible. And I think most people outside the ranks of Donald Trump supporters know we are not going to deport 11 million people who are across the border illegally. So I think that the conservative base looks at all this. Election after election, they're promised, if you vote conservative this time, if you vote Republican, you will get what we promise you. I look at the administrations of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan and both Presidents Bush, and at the end of all of them, conservatives were disappointed. They tended not to blame Reagan, who was a hero to them from the Goldwater campaign, but they could hang all his sins on George H.W. Bush, who followed. And so I think this sense of disappointment is a big part of where Trump and Cruz come from. Lastly, the Republican Party for a very long time has gotten a lot of support from white working class voters. They have not delivered any material benefits to these voters, and people don't have to trust me on that. I am a liberal, and I'm very clear about that in the book. Conservative writers like Ross Douthat, who writes a column for the New York Times, Rayhan Salam, who's a very interesting conservative intellectual, they have warned the party for years that this party of Sam's Club electorate that the Republicans have relied on is really disappointed, and I think they're expressing their disappointment through Trump.
Let's go to Reagan for a moment before we get more contemporary. You talk about the dilemma of Ronald Reagan's legacy and the quote, and you can talk about where it came from in a moment, but the quote that really sums it up is, you can choose your Reagan.
Right. For this book, I interviewed a significant number of conservative writers, intellectuals, politicians, activists, pollsters, congressmen. You know, and it was a very interesting process because they knew from my column that I come from the liberal side of things, but they accepted that I was trying to understand this very complicated story. And that quote, you can choose your Reagan, came from Charles Krauthammer, the very conservative columnist, Fox News commentator. And the point he was making, which I make in the first chapter, which is why I used his quote at the beginning, is that Reagan's legacy is absolutely ambiguous. There is Reagan, the movement builder, that Reagan, who, by the way, like Barack Obama, came to national prominence through one important speech. In Obama's case, we know it's at the 2004 election. In Reagan's case, it was a speech he gave right before the Goldwater defeat on national television called The Time for Choosing. And the right wing of the party looks at Reagan as a hero who organized the movement. Well, that's true enough. But the Reagan who governed, and who governed notably with a Democratic House under Tip O'Neill, was a much more pragmatic figure. He was willing to raise taxes after he cut them. He took seriously that Gorbachev actually might want to change the Soviet Union and came under a lot of attack from the right for believing that. He backed off some of his more ambitious initiatives when they ran into trouble, for example, in the environmental sphere. So he was definitely a conservative. I think liberals now like to say Reagan couldn't win a Republican nomination because the party has moved so far to the right. There's something to that. But he clearly was a movement conservative in his origins, but much more pragmatic in the way he governed. And that's why, on the one hand, almost every kind of Republican can say they're a Reaganite because it means so many different things. On the other hand, it's why his legacy is problematic for Republicans because it depends very much on which Reagan you identify with.
And then in writing about the Bushes, you talk about what complicated figures they are within the Republican Party because, quite frankly, many conservatives just never have trusted them.
That's absolutely right. And that with George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, when Reagan raised taxes, they just figured, oh, we had to do that. When Bush raised taxes, they kind of figured he wanted to do that, and they never fully trusted him. After all, George H.W. Bush had called Reagan's economic program voodoo economics, and they never really forgot that. They also came from a moderate Republican legacy. Their grandfather, Prescott Bush, was an Eisenhower Republican. Ike, by the way, is a kind of hero in my book. He was an Eisenhower Republican who wasn't afraid to use the word progressive. He talked about progressive moderation. And then George W. Bush was equally complicated because, on the one hand, when he was running in 1999 for president, he understood that Bill Clinton had had a lot of successes and that he had repositioned the Democratic Party, that the Gingrich Congress was very unpopular. And so he was trying to present himself as more moderate, as a compassionate conservative. And I write quite a lot about compassionate conservatism in the book, both its promise and the ways in which it's fallen short. So at the beginning of Bush's term, conservatives were so desperate to win back the presidency that they went along with these Bush corrections. But over time, number one, Bush largely gave up on this project, partly because of 9/11, partly because it hadn't worked as well in the 2000 election as he had hoped, but also because a lot of conservatives came to see Bush not in terms of a quite conservative presidency that liberals see in terms of the Iraq intervention or a steep tax cut. The conservatives started looking at him as a big government conservative who passed No Child Left Behind, the Medicare prescription drug benefit, and who ran deficits, even though most of the spending was in Basra or Baghdad, not Buffalo or Biloxi. So the Bushes ended up, particularly W., oddly ended up paving the way for the Tea Party, as I write in the book. The Tea Party really started as a sentiment, if not a movement, under Bush, not under Obama.
You do say in the book that under Bush, the cleansing of the Republican Party of all moderate and progressive influences was nearly completed and the Tea Party would do the rest.
Right. Well, if you go back to 1964, once Goldwater and the conservative movement took over the Republican Party, they instituted a sort of a purge over a period of time, defeating a lot of moderate and liberal Republicans in the primaries. Started in 1968 in California with Senator Tom Kuchel, continued with Clifford Case in New Jersey, and then, of course, Jacob Javits, who lost a Republican primary in New York to Alphonse D'Amato. And those three are just representative of what was happening across the country over a long period of time, so that not only were all liberal Republicans, and as you know well, living in Albany, Nelson Rockefeller was one of those.
Right.
Not only were liberal Republicans driven out, but so were moderates over time. And with that, moderates began to leave the Republican electorate. In the 90s, you saw a big sorting out that continued under President George W. Bush, where the Republican Party, in terms of its makeup in the primary electorate, is far, far more conservative than it was even 25 years ago. And again, people who are mystified by the strength of Trump and Cruz just have to look at who calls themselves Republican now. Many more people in the party are conservative or very conservative than were 20 or 25 years ago.
You do make the point that George W. Bush was ultimately left with the worst of both worlds. Progressives were unhappy with him because they saw him as right wing and great misadventures there. But the right itself mistrusted him because they felt with No Child Left Behind and the Medicare prescription drug benefit that he was abandoning them as well.
Right. That's exactly right. And there was another element, I think, in the way in which conservatives wanted to redefine W's legacy. He was broadly seen as a failure by the electorate by 2008. It's one reason Barack Obama was elected. You know, the polling made very clear that most Americans had decided this whole experiment hadn't worked. Conservatives really had two choices at that moment. They could go back and reexamine their own conservatism to the extent that it was reflected in many of Bush's policies, or they could, if you will, double down on conservatism and explain his failures not in terms of, say, Hurricane Katrina or the Terry Schiavo controversy, which we could get into if we wanted, or the Iraq War or the tax cut. They didn't want to sort of abandon that. So it was far more functional for them to declare Bush as some kind of big government guy, almost a liberal, and then say that the path ahead for the party was to become even more conservative. And in the book, I talk about the ironies of this because you saw figures like Eric Cantor in the House or Kevin McCarthy in the House really welcome the Tea Party and implicitly make this critique of Bush. And then, of course, both of them suffered at the hands of the very movement they were building with this kind of rhetoric. Eric Cantor lost a primary, and Kevin McCarthy was blocked as Speaker of the House. So that one of the quotations I'm very fond of is from John Kennedy, who said, "He who foolishly rides to power on the back of the tiger usually ends up inside." And I argue that many in the so-called Washington establishment who rode the Tea Party to power ended up as a kind of feast for the very elements they were initially encouraging.
E.J. DeYoung's new book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation with E.J. DeYoung right after this short break. E.J. DeYoung is a best-selling author, Washington Post syndicated columnist, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and professor at Georgetown University. He's also a regular commentary right here on National Public Radio as well as MSNBC. His new book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. One of the things that has always mystified me in talking about the Tea Party is its leadership and sort of this shadow that it has. And yet, who are the clear leaders and who is the Tea Party?
Fundamentally, I think the Tea Party represents a kind of right wing or a far right, however you want to define it, of American opinion that has been there for a very, very long time. 20 to 25% of Americans are very, very conservative. That was true in 1964. It's true today. The Tea Party was, I think, in significant part, a very clever marketing move by conservatives to redefine themselves as something new, this part of the party. And yes, there was a kind of eruption, again, first against President Bush, but then with the election of President Obama. In fact, one of the points I make in the book is that you saw some of these very angry elements at McCain rallies toward the end of the 2008 campaign, where they were already yelling things about President Obama being a Muslim, asking questions about where he was born. All these questions were first surfaced in the campaign. And so the Tea Party was the traditional American right wing, but it had some advantages in 2009. One was funding from some leading, you know, very wealthy conservatives. David Frum, the conservative writer, calls them the radical rich. The Koch brothers are probably the most famous. They also now had an extraordinary infrastructure of talk radio programs, with Rush Limbaugh being the pioneer of those back in the 80s and then spawning lots of imitators. They had Fox News, which was born in the mid-90s and then became the first number one cable network under President Bush. And for a while, and she's back, they had Sarah Palin, who after the 2008 election became a real hero to the right wing. So in many ways, this is the old, old right with some new advantages and some new forms of organization. But their ideas, as I say, you can trace way back to Goldwater or even to some degree to the 1930s and the opposition of Franklin Roosevelt. The ideas haven't changed very much.
You make the point that there is historical context here, of course, and we have talked about it so far in our discussion. But really, have you seen anything like we're seeing now?
In a way, that's a very interesting, almost philosophical question about what is it exactly that we are seeing now.
Yeah, I have no idea. I really don't.
No, I think it's a good question. Well, you know, let's sort of separate the new from the old. We have elected an actor as president. We've had people from all kinds of walks of life, business leaders getting into politics. Donald Trump is kind of sui generis. He is sui generis, first of all, because he's changed his views so much over the years, because we've never really had reality show politics before. He got his first big audience, in a way, through first the gossip pages and then through his television show. And you've never seen a candidate who could say so many outrageous things and not pay much of a price with his base. On the other hand, I think there's been a dangerous tendency to look at Trump and say that because he is the leader in a fractured Republican field, he represents lots and lots of Americans. If you actually take Donald Trump's share of the total vote, in other words, the percentage of Republicans who are for Trump and how much of the country do they constitute, we're talking about sort of somewhere, depending on the poll, between 13 and on the high side, 20% of Americans. That means the vast majority of Americans are not for Donald Trump. His disapproval rating among women, which is more than half the country, according to one poll I looked at the other day, is at 62%. So Trump is new, but again, the sentiment he represents is not all that new. And similarly for Ted Cruz, he is an ideological conservative politician. Now, here's what is new that I think we're just beginning to wrap our heads around, all of us. And that is that you're seeing the far right splitting in a new way, where you have what you might call the reality show conservatives or the populist conservatives, whichever word you want to use, you know, represented by Trump, Sarah Palin and their supporters, and the really hard ideological conservatives represented by Ted Cruz. In the Tea Party, those two elements came together, and right now they seem to be going off in different directions. That is going to be very interesting to watch as the year goes forward.
Your point about the 20% is well taken. However, when you look at the polls, and I guess it ultimately comes down to how much do we trust these polls, but when you look at the polls of a Trump versus Clinton general election matchup, it's 44% to 41%, according to the latest numbers. And that is far more split and to me shows that he has greater support.
Well, I think that we are now so divided in partisan terms that there really isn't a lot of give on the partisan numbers. I mean, Barack Obama won two very significant victories, but even as he won, John McCain got 46%. When the economy was literally falling apart, when Americans were absolutely fed up with the war in Iraq, and yet John McCain still got 46%. Mitt Romney got 47%. I think that we are, if you were to take a kind of typical election, of which there is no such thing, and look at the demographics of the country, we are probably at heart about a 53% to 47% Democratic country. And I think one of the arguments I make in the book that where you ask the question, how will conservatism and the Republican Party change? I think demographics over time are going to force this change, because where conservatism is strong, it's strong among rather old white Americans, you know, Americans over the age of 50. By the way, I'm over the age of 50, so I say this with no criticism of that group. But if you are running a political party and looking down the road 20 years, you don't want your base to be as old as the Republican base now is. The party is almost uniformly white. We are a country in which the Asian population, the Latino population, the African-American population, the non-white population is growing. And so I think that there are a lot of shrewd Republicans who look down the road and say, this is a problem for us. One of the people I quote in the book is Jim Brulte, who is a very smart chairman of the Republican Party out in California, which has become an overwhelmingly Democratic state. And its demographics are now where the United States will probably get in 20 years. And Jim Brulte says, look, if the Republicans continue down this path, they're going to find themselves in the same fix we California Republicans are now in. And so I think there is a long-term crisis for the party. They can win midterm elections because older people outvote younger people in midterm elections. But over time, they face a crisis, and the smartest among them know it.
Speaking of crisis, is the Hillary Clinton campaign in a crisis?
I'm not sure it's in a crisis. My read of the Democratic race is that, number one, if I said last October, and I don't think it took any genius to see this, that Bernie Sanders had a really good shot at winning both Iowa and New Hampshire. Why? Because demographically, those states are very congenial to him. The electorate is much more heavily white than other electorates in the later primaries, and Bernie is stronger among white voters than he is among African Americans and Latinos. Secondly, they tend to be in the Iowa electorate in the caucuses tends to be quite liberal, and he is right next door to New Hampshire. And thirdly, I think there's a lot of anger in the Democratic Party at what Democrats see as the obstructionism of the last several years, and Bernie really speaks very effectively to that frustration. I think, on the other hand, where I think Clinton's stock is probably being undersold now, because even if, worst case for her, she loses Iowa and New Hampshire, the later primaries stack up to be quite favorable to her. And I think a lot of Democrats are going through, I think this race is close not only in the polls in certain places, but in the minds of Democrats, where I think Democrats are very torn between a Sanders argument that says, let us say what we stand for and fight the election that way, and a Clinton argument that says, yes, we should say what we stand for, but we have to be tough and pragmatic because this is a very hard time in which to govern. And I think it's going to be very interesting to watch that argument play out in the Democratic primaries, because I think pieces of each argument appeals to some of the same people in the party.
If it plays out to the point where at the end of February, it's still not clear, do you believe that Mayor Bloomberg will enter the race?
I am skeptical of that. I don't think he'll enter the race if Hillary Clinton is the nominee.
Yes.
I think it's possible that in a Trump-Sanders race, for example, he might see some room to get in. I think the difficulty of a Bloomberg candidacy, and he's a very practical guy, I'm sure he's going to look at these numbers, is that Bloomberg is very likely to appeal far more to Democratic-leaning voters, including independents, than Republicans. His very, very strong stand in favor of gun control, which, by the way, I applaud, I admire his work for gun control, leaves him completely out of consideration in many of the most Republican states in the country. So I think the danger to Bloomberg of a Bloomberg candidacy is he might help elect the candidate he least likes in the race. He does not want to be a kind of Ralph Nader of the center, if you will. So I think that's very much on his mind as he calculates what he's going to do. But if Clinton secures a Democratic nomination, I don't think Bloomberg is going to get in the race. And he's kind of hinted at that himself.
He has hinted at that. And it seems, and you have hinted, that you think that once the initial primaries are done, that the dust will settle and Hillary Clinton's campaign will be on more solid footing.
If I had to bet, that's what I would bet. Now, politics always pulls surprise. That's one thing I learned when I covered Albany all those years ago. And pundits have a lot to answer for so far this year. Nonetheless, I think the fundamentals do favor Clinton. The national polls have tended to give her a rather sizable lead. And people forget also, there's one of the points I make in the book is that we are going through a period of asymmetric polarization, that the Republicans, if you just poll the members, people who say they're Republican or Democratic, the Republican Party is far more dominated by conservatives than the Democratic Party is dominated by liberals or people on the left. The Democrats are far more likely, a significant majority of Democrats, when you ask them, if you ask the question, do you prefer a politician who would compromise to get things done or sticks to principle, roughly 6 Democrats in 10 say compromise. Among Republicans, it's only a little over a third. So these are very different parties. I think that also, in the long run, operates in Clinton's favor.
Having worked in Albany, you know that Saratoga is not very far away, and there is a racetrack there. So if you were to bet on the on a long shot, or wanted to bet on a long shot, for among the Republican candidates, who would that be at this point?
Well, I have thought until about a week ago that the guy best positioned to win the Republican nomination was Ted Cruz, because of where the center of gravity is in the Republican Party right now. But these attacks on Cruz, a kind of pincer movement from Donald Trump and Marco Rubio on the other side, has, I think, sort of endangered him. And if Trump actually wins in Iowa and then wins New Hampshire, he becomes very hard to stop. My very long shot theory, I wrote a column about this about 10 days ago, is John Kasich in New Hampshire, where I argued that there is an outside chance for Kasich in New Hampshire because so many independent voters can vote in the Republican primary, and he's making a real appeal to independents. So that's my, if Bookie gave me some odds just about New Hampshire, I would probably take him on Kasich. The problem for Kasich is, where does he move after New Hampshire? It's hard to see him doing really well in the Southern primaries.
And the first, of course, the first big one being South Carolina.
Correct. And, you know, Rubio is a kind of popular favorite, if you will, within the conventional wisdom. He may be the only candidate who can finish at least third in Iowa and second in New Hampshire. I think Rubio's problem, his strength is he appeals to all wings of the Republican Party, potentially. His problem is the same, which is it's not clear which wing he is in, and I think he's muddied his image a little bit, moving from a kind of optimistic message when he started to mimicking the sort of dark pessimism of Cruz and Trump. That will either, in his calculation, put him in contention with them, or I think muddy his image in a way that he may not be able to put together the strong showings he needs. We'll see which one of those works out.
You're a liberal. How scared are you of a Trump presidency?
I don't think the American people are going to make Donald Trump president. That is something I'd be willing to put a fair amount of money on with no odds, a lot of money on with no odds at all.
But wouldn't you have done the same, that he wouldn't be the nominee?
I think anybody who's honest with the people they're talking to would say that no one expected Trump to get this far. But if you look at the numbers right where Trump is now, and he is certainly looking very strong now for the Republican nomination, the attitudes toward him among so many groups of Americans, I mentioned women, Latinos, young people, I think there are plenty of moderate suburban type voters and even moderate conservatives who, in a race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, would see Clinton as the safer candidate. And many of them might not be wild about voting for Clinton in this particular category I'm talking about, but I don't think they'd want to take the risk of Donald Trump being president. And as we saw recently, the National Review magazine devoted its whole issue to a symposium called Against Trump. I think there are plenty of conservatives, you know, some of whom have written it openly, David Brooks in the New York Times, Mike Gerson in the Washington Post, and all those National Review conservatives, I think, would rather see the Republicans lose than have Donald Trump as president. So I think he runs into much heavier going if he wins the nomination.
The name of the book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. It is published by Simon & Schuster. E.J. Dionne, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Oh, real joy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
A delight. Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.